This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll hear from UC Davis School of Medicine Associate Dean Dr. Brad Pullock about what's working and what isn't with California's COVID-19 testing strategy. And we'll hear how to better protect yourself from smoke this wildfire season. If you have questions or comments for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216, or you can go to our website, mynspr.org. For Wednesday, July 15th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. A Glenn County septuagenarian has died from the coronavirus pandemic, Glenn County public health officials announced Wednesday. The fatality lifts the death toll from the virus across the 11-county North State region to 19. Officials described the person as a North County resident who had several chronic conditions and had been hospitalized for an extended period. Officials were unsure where or how they contracted the virus. The death comes as 39 other North State residents are hospitalized in 9 different counties. Meanwhile, scores of new cases were identified Wednesday, mostly in the Valley, raising the number of people infected locally to 1,871. Public health officials in Sutter County have now confirmed the coronavirus in 441 different people. Butte County officials have confirmed 437, Yuba County 221, Sutter 209, Glenn 190, Colusa 140, Tehama 126, Siskiyou 43, Lassen 41, Plumas 21, and Trinity County 2. A new mandate requiring facial masks for anyone entering a medical facility was issued in Tehama County by order of County Health Officer Richard Wickenheiser. The order is in place until further notice. Also in Tehama County, officials there say 50 different medical offices, government agencies, doctors, and dentists will be receiving face shields manufactured through a quasi-volunteer effort organized by Idea Fab Labs, a Chico-based tech company. The firm has helped shepherd efforts to use 3D printers owned by members of the community and others to manufacture PPE. Recognizing the financial hardship faced by restaurateurs, the city of Chico is throwing them a bone. Restaurants may offer table service using one of two permit options, either a free permit using outdoor parking lots or adjacent landscaping on private property, or a $175 permit allowing table service on sidewalks or public space if it doesn't impede pedestrians and complies with the ADA. Statewide, fatalities blamed on COVID-19 surged by 140 Wednesday, the most recent figure available from the California Department of Public Health. A total of 665 Californians have died from COVID-19 over the 7 days ending Wednesday. The deaths of 7,227 Californians have been attributed to the virus. Public health authorities confirmed more than 11,100 cases, a near record, sending the total statewide caseload to 347,634. The department reported 8,353 people hospitalized with the coronavirus or suspected coronavirus across the state, just over 100 more than Tuesday. A testing clinic for the coronavirus will be available in Susanville Thursday at the Public Health Department from 9 to noon. Register for a test online at projectbaseline.com and click on COVID-19. For help, call 251-8100. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. As outbreaks of COVID-19 continue throughout California, the state is revamping how it's addressing its testing issues in hopes to speed up testing results, contact tracing, and getting people into quarantine. The plan includes a 4-tier priority system for testing. Those hospitalized with COVID-19 symptoms will be at the top of the list, along with those who have had close contact with others who have been infected, followed by those living in high-risk facilities like nursing homes, prisons, and homeless shelters, and then healthcare and emergency service workers. Today, we'll hear more about the state's testing strategy from UC Davis School of Medicine Associate Dean, Dr. Brad Pullock. He recently spoke with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Randall White, about what is and what is not working with testing in the state. Randall started the conversation by asking Dr. Pollack to explain the difference between the two types of tests out there, viral and antibody tests.
The antibody tests, while they have some useful purposes, including sort of characterizing, you know, how much of the population has been exposed or infected, they really don't help at the individual level. They don't help contain the epidemic whatsoever. So it's really the viral PCR RNA test. That's the one that detects the actual presence of the virus at the time the test is done.
This is the
Those
swab
the
in the
tests
nose.
That are needed. Yeah, the swab in the nose. There are some other tests are being developed now that may compete with that, but they essentially look at virus present when they do the test. And that's going to be the absolute necessary information to be able to get somebody into isolation or quarantine. So that's really kind of the key driver right now, is having these viral tests available and having them available appropriately. And if you recall, I guess about a month and a half ago when I was on Insight, you know, we had a discussion about testing strategies. And at the time, and I still believe this, Dr. David Lebarski and I, David's the Vice Chancellor of Human Health Sciences and the CEO of UC Davis Health, we actually put out a little paper that talked about this sort of massive general asymptomatic testing in the population versus doing more targeted testing. And as the as the supply chain has dried up to be able to do these tests freely, now we're moving more toward a strategy of doing targeted testing.
Which is what state is calling for.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, to emphasize Peter's points also, you know, one of the key things is having those tests available for folks that need to be tested right away. And if you're doing contact tracing, for example, if you're doing contact tracing, you need to be able to reach out to folks quickly and try to identify people that were possibly exposed, and then test them, test the folks that of course, that have come to attention. But having that rapid turnaround of testing is really critical to sort of to contain the epidemic now. So that's really kind of the key thing right now. We don't have enough testing capacity. One of the reasons right now, it's not for the state lacking in this. I mean, we've gone from doing, you know, a couple months ago, 20,000 tests a day to 100,000 a day. But the problem right now is that the supply chain for some of the things that are needed to do the test, the reagents, the chemicals that are used for the tests, the swabs that are used to collect the samples, and even the media in which the swabs are placed to preserve it enough to be able to get tested, these are in short supply, and the supply chain has been disrupted. So now we're moving much more toward a targeted testing strategy, which I think is more efficient anyway.
Mm-hmm. Every time I mention to someone that I've been tested or I plan to get tested, they always say to me, "Doctor, but those aren't even accurate. Like, why are you doing that?" And early on, that was the case, right? When we go back to March and April, how has testing evolved, and should we have confidence in them?
Well, I think that's a good question, Randall. I think the issue is there's no such thing as a perfect test. There's inaccuracy for any test that you have. You're trying to get better tests. And there's two ways we look at this. One is sensitivity and specificity. So it's really looking at the test's ability to correctly identify people that have the disease as well as people that do not have the disease. And they're usually not perfect. We try to get toward perfection. So as the testing modalities have evolved, we've gotten more accurate, but there's still some degree of uncertainty and misclassification built into any of the testing modalities here. There was an article that Jane Brody published, I think yesterday or the day before, which really talked about this, that you can still miss cases. There's the issue of missing cases, and that is having false negative results, which is a problem because you're not going to identify people that potentially could spread it. And that is a function, one, of the test itself, which may be imperfect, but also sometimes it's just you don't luck out in terms of getting the swab in the right place. Mm. And number three, there's the biologic variability for every person. You may not be shedding a lot of virus at the moment that they're doing the swab test, and maybe that kicks up, you know, a half day later. So you've got all these things that contribute to not necessarily having a perfect test result, which would allow you to, with certainty, say, here's what's going on.
Now, just for my own curiosity, because I know how you feel about the antibody tests, but I did go get one and it came back negative. Now, I was looking to see if a terrible virus that I had back in late February, early March could have been novel coronavirus. And I guess it still could have been right because those antibodies that my body created may have already left my system. I'm hearing there's like a 3-month window now that they've targeted.
Yeah, it's not that they've left your system, but when you have an antibody response to an infection, it's not constant. So you have to it takes a while to build up the antibodies, and the nature of the antibodies that are produced changes over time as well. There's an immediate onslaught of these antibodies that are called IgM, which show up sort of 2 or 3 days perhaps after infection, and they kind of disappear pretty quickly afterwards. And then IgG, another type of antibodies, that class of antibodies starts getting developed, and those provide longer term protection, we think. And it may also be that it's not the quantity of the antibody, but the fact that you develop specific subcomponents of antibodies that really are the things that protect you. We don't know enough right now. We're really trying to get the information about what are the protective elements of the antibodies you produce that are going to keep you out of trouble. And we don't know that right now. That's why we're doing some studies to look at cohorts of individuals that are infected and see what happens over time to see whether they have protective immunity, whether they're still capable of infecting other people. So we don't know. So you may have a very low antibody count, raw count, but it may be that you have plenty of that protective subcomponent that's there. We just don't know at this point.
And there is at least one benefit, right, to finding out who may have been infected in the past, because you can take their blood or their plasma, I guess, right, and use that as a treatment for people who are currently suffering from COVID-19?
Yes, there's a class of folks that have been infected that they do mount a fairly large antibody response. They can provide the sera that could be available for others. And that actually, it's very much like the passive immunity we've done for years when you had an IV immunoglobulin injection, right, for hepatitis in the old days. You're getting somebody else's antibodies, the antibodies there, that may protect you if you're sick. And so this sera has been available now, and it's not widely available, but not everybody who's infected, in fact, and recovers even, will necessarily mount a large quantitative response. So not everybody is necessarily an appropriate donor who's recovered. You have to sort of screen people for that.
All right, Dr. President Donald Trump tweeted out this morning, great news on vaccines, with no other follow-up data. Is this likely over Moderna's potential vaccine that is heading into the final stage of testing?
Well, I don't know what he was referring to. Clearly, they're in phase three. They're starting their phase three tests right now, Moderna. There are other candidate vaccines that are in trials now, and they're moving toward these larger phase three trials. These are very large trials that may involve 30 to 60,000 individuals to see whether they're effective or not. So it does take time to do this. But, you know, I would say that we have made great progress in vaccine development. The government is planning to put into production maybe 5 or 6 candidate vaccines prior to knowing which one is going to be the best one. And they're doing that so that when we do discover the best vaccine, we will already have some stockpile there. So it's an unusual move, and it's a very expensive move because you're essentially going to be supporting the production of 3 or 4 or 5 other vaccines, which aren't going to be the ones that get deployed.
Just to give people a sense of vaccine timelines, this is a rapid rate compared to anything we've seen in the past.
Absolutely. This is unprecedented to see this level of vaccine development from the start of a novel approach to doing the vaccine to creation of a test product to phase one and phase two. So, I mean, this timeline has been so accelerated, which is great. Part of that's a result of the money and resources that have been spent on this, but also part of it's the technology. We know a lot more about immunology than we did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So we have a lot more laboratory and methodological approaches that can be deployed now that weren't available back then. But it's a combination of an all-out effort, I think, to sort of do this and also mobilizing the clinical research apparatus that's needed to actually do these vaccine trials. You know, it's not easy to do a clinical trial with 20,000, 30,000, 60,000 people. So I think that also has moved along much greater in the last 20 years, particularly with the investments that the National Institutes of Health have done to shore up the clinical translational research infrastructure in this country. I think that's really contributed to this.
In news stories, we've pretty much dropped the word novel, but it is called the novel coronavirus for a reason. It's a new one. because there's old ones and we've been studying those, and that helps as well, right? We already sort of have a leg up on how coronavirus work. I don't know what the plural is, coronavirus.
Yeah, we do. It's a little bit of a leg up, but you know, this virus, this coronavirus is not like the other ones. It's not like the original SARS or MERS. It's not like the more common cold viruses that we see. So we know a lot about sort of the biology of the virus, but it's not, it just is just working a little bit differently. There's no seasonal component to the epidemic, which is something that was more characteristic of other coronaviruses. So, you know, it's novel, it's different. There's some similarities. It's helped us certainly in terms of the approaches we're taking now with therapeutics, of course, as well as for vaccine prevention. But we still a lot we don't know, obviously, and that's why we're doing research.
That was UC Davis School of Medicine Associate Dean Dr. Brad Pollack, speaking with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Randall White. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. More just ahead.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, using research and evidence to develop solutions that help families and communities create a brighter future for young people. More information is available at aecf.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, offering a selection of tires, shopping tools, and user reviews to help people find the right tires for their car and driving conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. From iDrive, maker of a remote PC, providing access to computers anywhere for remote assistance and work from home, featuring Remote PC Meeting, a video conferencing tool. More at remotepc.com. And from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, NA.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Preparing for wildfire season includes a lot. Creating 50 feet of defensible space around your home, signing up for your county's emergency alert system, having a go bag packed and ready, and having an evacuation plan created and rehearsed. But even if you're not in a high-risk fire zone, there's also another important health threat we see every year from wildfires that you should consider. Wildfire smoke. And this year, officials are saying it's really important to defend yourself from it because smoke can reduce the body's ability to fight infections and viruses, and it can worsen the symptoms of respiratory illnesses like COVID-19. To learn more about what you can do to better protect yourself from poor air quality this fire season, NSPR's Matt Fidler spoke with Jason Mandley, the air quality planner for the Butte County Air Quality Management District. Matt started off by confessing to Jason that he'd never actually heard of an air quality planner before.
We do have plans established to get us on the path to meet clean air standards. I guess that's the main place where planner comes into play. Also, I do environmental review on any CEQA documents where planning is required. But I also keep an eye on wildfire smoke, track it to see if it's going to impact our area, try to increase the amount of monitoring that our district is doing. The California Air Resources Board does most of the monitoring in our county. However, we've been trying to put out low-cost sensors in more areas throughout the Butte County to have more of a monitoring presence so folks can know more specifically what their air quality is in the local area.
What can a citizen of the North State do to prepare their homes for a possible, you know, week of smoky conditions?
Well, the best thing to do is to make sure that your home, or at least one or two rooms in your home, can be clean. Have lower particulates than the outside air if there was a wildfire. One way to do that is if you have a house with a central HVAC system, you have a place where you can put a filter. And a lot of these filters are available at a lot of the local hardware stores, or you can buy them online. many houses and many places have what's called a MERV rating on their filters, M-E-R-V, and that's kind of the efficiency of their filter. MERV 13 filters are usually the grade of filters that start filtering out wildfire smoke. And there's also MERV 14 and 15, which are even better, but also more expensive. It is good to have extra MERV 13 filters on hand if possible. In case there is a wildfire, because these filters can filter out a lot of that wildfire smoke.
What if you don't have an HVAC system?
All right, so if you don't have a central HVAC system, the best thing to do would be to find a room in your home where you're going to spend a lot of your time if there was a wildfire, and do what you can to prepare it. That could be purchasing a portable air filtration system, a HEPA filter, so that you at least have one room that can have improved air quality, somewhere usually that you would spend a lot of time, perhaps the bedroom if you're going to be, of course, sleeping there. You want to have good air quality. And also somewhere where this would also be a room where you don't have too many leaks to the outside or where it's not drawing in outside air. There are portable air filters available locally and online. Some air purifiers may not be appropriate. I know there are some that create ozone, and these air purifiers generally are not the ones that you want to look for when trying to protect your room from wildfire smoke. You want to go more for the HEPA filter type that can really remove a lot of the particulates at a high efficiency.
Okay. So now what about small business owners? What do you recommend for business owners, especially those with employees, to do to prepare for a smoking condition to make a safe work atmosphere?
But yeah, I mean, as far as our guidance to businesses, it would be the same as homes. If they have, you know, a central HVAC system where they can put in some higher grade filtration or at least create some safe spaces at the place of work. From what I understand, Cal OSHA has emergency regulations in place now regarding wildfire smoke and the workplace. I would need to get back to you on the details of that, but Cal OSHA is the lead on that.
Okay, great. So now as far as kind of deciding if you want to go outside or not, maybe it's part of your work if you're, you know, in construction or public service or agriculture. Can you use your eyes to judge whether it's, you know, too smoky or not to go out? Like normally I can see 10 blocks down the street. Now I can only see 4 blocks down the street because of the smoke. And so I know that's the cutoff. Are your eyes a reliable, you know, measurement of the smoky conditions outside?
Yeah, you know, visibility can certainly give you a rough estimate. On our air quality index chart, which breaks out the different categories of poor air quality, whether it's moderate, unhealthy for sensitive groups, unhealthy for all, very unhealthy, et cetera. There is a visibility range in miles that corresponds with it. So if you can only see about a mile ahead of you, that's a good indication that air quality might be getting into the unhealthy or very unhealthy range. But we do have that chart available on our website. Again, it's a rough estimate. Nowadays, we do have links to almost real-time data on our website, and that's another way that folks can check to see the air quality in their local area.
Can you give us the website address for that?
Yeah, so our main website is butteairquality.com, and we have links to both the official monitoring stations. We have one in Chico, one in Gridley, and one in Paradise. Those are the official monitors for our area, but we also have what are known as purple air sensors. These are low-cost but easily deployable sensors that we have in several locations around the county, including Oroville, Thermalito, Magalia, Nord, Biggs, Palermo. And so we have these in some of the smaller communities around the county, as well as dispersed throughout Chico and Oroville, to kind of give a better sense of how air quality is at a more localized level. The link to that data is also on our website at butteairquality.com.
What are the symptoms that you might expect someone to have when they've had overexposure to smoke?
Well, of course, those that have pre-existing conditions, some of their symptoms from, for example, asthma may be exacerbated. Usually there's stinging or watering eyes might impact everyone. Um, if, if air quality is poor enough, it could also lead to difficulty breathing.
What about with people with COVID-19? Is there a higher risk of severe symptoms with the coronavirus and smoky conditions?
Well, certainly, you know, those with any sort of respiratory conditions, whether it's COVID-19 or any COPD, asthma, any respiratory conditions, are more susceptible to be impacted by wildfire smoke. So we would, you know, we would consider those with COVID-19 to be included in that group. And so they would want to take a look at air quality. There is an AQI category called unhealthy for sensitive groups. And so those impacted by COVID-19 would fall under that sensitive groups category.
So because of COVID-19, a lot of us, should be all of us, have masks, like the cloth masks. Are those going to be effective for smoky conditions?
Right, yeah. So unfortunately, a lot of the cloth masks that are available right now due to COVID-19 are not adequate to filter out smoke particles. They're very small. They can get through cotton. They can get through cloth. And they can get through a lot of the dust masks, the surgical masks, bandanas that folks are wearing. And so it would take something like an N95 respirator to protect you from wildfire smoke if you had to be outdoors. And so, you know, as you know right now, there's somewhat of a shortage with the higher grade N95 respirators. So the best suggestion would be to, you know, if possible, stay indoors. If there was to be a major wildfire creating unhealthy conditions, and if indoors, you know, try to find a space with air filtration.
Are there places in Butte County where people can seek, you know, like clean air spaces if they don't have access to one?
So there were shelters in place during the campfire, of course. The best thing to do in Butte County, the government of Butte County would be the best point of contact on this, were there to be a wildfire emergency, but is to just check in on, with local media and the county on a case-by-case basis. If a wildfire were to appear, there would be information on which places would be appropriate. Of course, you know, there needs to be some nuance because of COVID-19 with regards to the clean air shelters. But again, there would be direction coming from the county or from local law enforcement or officials.
Is there anything else about air quality and wildfires that you'd like our listeners to know about that I didn't ask you about?
Well, you know, we just hope for the best. But if we were to be impacted by wildfire either locally or, you know, from afar, because some smoke can travel hundreds of miles depending on where the wildfire is, if we are to be impacted, you can check butteairquality.com for real-time air quality data. We also have links on our website with more information on how to protect yourself from poor air quality. We have links to fact sheets on how to set up some air filtration in your home, how to protect your pets, and some other information like that.
That was Jason Mandley, air quality planner for the Butte County Air Quality Management District, speaking with NSPR's Matt Fidler. And that is your program. As always, if you have any thoughts for us, you can leave them on our message line 433-9216 or on our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Radaviel, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. A special thanks to CAP Radio. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.